You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello and welcome to this podcast, Advances in the Delayed Onset of Type 1 Diabetes, Strategies to Improve Awareness and Care for the Practicing Clinician, hosted by Med Learning Group. I'm Shpit Team and I'll be the host of today's podcast. Today I'm joined by Dr. Chuck Vega, Health Sciences Clinical Professor at UC Irvine Department of Family Medicine in Irvine, California. And today we'll discuss the importance and application of screening for type 1 diabetes or T1D, as well as what to do post-screening and when to intervene with disease-modifying therapies for T1D, with a specific focus on the role of primary care clinicians across this continuum of care. Dr. Vega, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's great to be here, Shpadim. Please call me Chuck. Thanks very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Chuck. So first, help us set up the stage as to why screening for T1D is important. And from a primary care perspective, how is screening different than what traditionally has been done in practice?
Right. Well, traditionally, we have not been screening for type 1 diabetes. I'm sure a lot of the clinicians listening in are very used to screening for type 2 diabetes, which we should be doing routinely for all adults in the United States. But when we think about the epidemiology of type 1 diabetes, it's about 5 to 10% of all folks with diabetes in the U.S. So it's not a small number. And the pathology is completely different. We're talking about an autoimmune disease with destruction of pancreatic islet cells that begins years before patients actually develop symptoms and is detectable. It's also has a lot more consequences at presentation because historically, 30% to 50% of cases of type 1 diabetes presented with diabetic ketoacidosis, which, as you know, is a really dangerous condition that that can put people in the ICU and can, unfortunately, kill a certain number of individuals with DKA. So our goal is to identify folks at risk of type 1 diabetes early, during the earliest stages of that autoimmune process before they have symptoms, to protect them later on.
Thank you. And just picking up from that, if you could briefly just overview the stages, especially the pre-symptomatic stages, and how that is kind of like fit in with what is done right now. I just wanted to have a little bit on that as well.
Right. So you don't need to have any dysglycemia. You can have completely normal glucose values, and I'm talking A1C, a 2-hour oral glucose tolerance challenge test, and fasting blood glucose, all normal, and still have type 1 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes, the diagnosis really is predicated on the presence of islet autoantibodies, and there are four of them that we test for routinely, and we should be testing for all four when we screen. And so just the presence of those autoantibodies indicates that the person has stage 1, type 1 diabetes. Of course, over time and at variable rates, we have to be mindful of that. That's one of the challenging things with type 1 diabetes is that every patient tends to advance through these stages at their own rates. But stage 2 is when there's dysglycemia, but not overt hyperglycemia. They're not at risk of a DKA in stage 2. But if you put them through an oral glucose tolerance test, if you do an A1C, you'll notice a mild elevation of blood glucose. So that's stage 2. And stage 3 is, unfortunately, where way too many patients are diagnosed. That's in overt diabetes with a sugar of 500. And they could be in acidosis by that time. Hopefully not, if we've been thinking about whom we need to screen, monitoring them over time, who have a lot of education. This is critically important. Patients are informed and their care partners are informed about the symptoms and signs of overt diabetes and DKA specifically. That can really reduce the number of people who get very sick before presenting to a clinician's care and getting taken care of, usually at that point with insulin.
Thank you. And you mentioned the autoantibodies, and I just wanted to ask a follow-up questions and how can we screen for type 1 diabetes in primary care, and just maybe teasing out the little differences in how we think about screening, particularly for type 2, more like glycemic measures. I wanted to ask about that and emphasizing that part for screening for T1D.
So that's a great question. So I think that once you have, if you're just doing glucose testing as a means to test for type 1 diabetes, unfortunately, you've already missed the best opportunity. You've missed the opportunity to find patients who could qualify for disease-modifying therapies and can start really start thinking about how they want to plan for the future, change lifestyle when it's clear that at some point they're going to develop overt diabetes. I think that's all very important for life planning, frankly. Whether you're talking about a 6-year-old or a 26-year-old or a 60-year-old, really anyone can develop type 1 diabetes. I would not recommend to screen everybody for type 1 diabetes, but really through national programs where there is assistance for testing and they are collecting epidemiological data, you can test anyone for type 1 diabetes and do so for free using those islet autoantibodies. So I think that it's definitely a shift over the past 10 years. And a lot of that is born the fact that now we can do something about it. We have disease-modifying therapy, one currently available, teplizumab, but then we also have others in the wings. And so there's also research studies that patients can get involved in for a variety of different agents. But generally, those are focused on those earlier stages, that stage 1 or stage 2 type 1 diabetes. So that's why it's key to identify patients early.
Thank you. And you alluded to some of this, but what are some of the challenges facing primary care when it comes to how to identify patients that should be screened for T1D?
Yeah, I think that is a challenge. I work in a busy community health center. That's where I'm sitting right now. Starting clinic in a bit. And I know that we are pulled in a million different directions. And a lot of that was preventive care, which is one of the reasons I went into family medicine, was the idea of prevention of disease and promoting wellness as opposed to just treating disease. So type 1 diabetes is certainly in that paradigm because when we identify folks at stage 2 type 1 diabetes, they might be able to qualify for treatment with teplizumab and therefore stave off the onset of overt diabetes by over 2 years. It's something pretty significant. But you have to know whom to screen, because I'm not screening everybody, nor are there recommendations right now in the United States to screen everybody. So who should we screen? Folks with a family history of type 1 diabetes, that's very important. Folks with a family history or a personal history of other autoimmune disease, like thyroid disease, either or Hashimoto's disease or Graves' disease, if they have celiac disease, that could be another sign. I think one of the things that is a challenge for me is just trying to get, particularly family history is a big challenge. So everybody has an uncle or a cousin with diabetes, but when I ask, well, do you know if that's type 1 or type 2? They don't know. And that's really common. So sometimes it's worth a phone call just to elaborate, because a family history of type 1 diabetes, of diabetes general, non-specified, in, say, a grandmother and your aunt and a cousin, if that's type 2 diabetes, means one thing. If they all have type 1 diabetes, that's quite another thing.
Thank you. And I just want to ask a question on also see a lot of adults in primary care, like the implications of kind of like the incidence of T1D in adults and then implications of that when it comes to screening and early detection and of course, misdiagnosis as well.
Yeah. So many patients who present with type 1 diabetes during adulthood are misdiagnosed. I think it's a lot of clinicians' mindset that once you get past age, say, 25, the risk of type 1 diabetes is very low. That's not true. We know that actually most incident cases of type 1 diabetes in the United States are diagnosed among individuals who are 20 and older. There's just a lot more adults than there are kids. That's why. So the incidence per 100,000 population at younger ages is higher. So you see that incidence rate higher. But if you look at the overall prevalence of type 1 diabetes, there are more cases among adults, which makes sense just from the math of it. So we always want to consider it, and I always have that in the back of my mind. I think what I tell folks is, because this has happened to me, that I have misdiagnosed somebody as type 2 diabetes. It's much more common among adults. It's something that, and also the clinical course of type 1 diabetes, less likely to present DKA, more of a slow burn in terms of loss of islet cells due to autoimmune phenomena in adults with type 1 diabetes. So it can look like type 2 diabetes. What I would advise is when you start treating the patient with typical medications for type 2 diabetes and lifestyle changes, and you notice that it's not working, they're actually getting worse or certainly not doing a lot better, go back and call into question some of your assumptions about this patient. Maybe they don't fit the phenotype of some of your type 2 diabetes. Their triglycerides are normal. Their waist circumference is normal. They don't have steatotic liver disease. And then ask again about family history, like who again, you know, oh, you have a family history of strong thyroid disease, huh? Your mother has it and your sister has it. That's going to be somebody where we're going to, you know, turn around and test. And so whenever a case of presumed type 2 diabetes, because I'm not doing any confirmatory testing for that, I'm just following glucose, it's not going the right way, always think, gosh, could this patient have type 1 diabetes? And then test for all four autoantibodies.
Thank you. Very important point. And after screening, say if someone tests positive, and there's implications of that in how many antibodies are positive, or if someone tests negative, what is the role that primary care clinicians play in further monitoring or referring patients to specialty care? And when should patients with test positive, when should they be referred? And I was going to ask how does this work in your own practice as well?
Right. So if they test positive, there are always two things are going to happen. One is I'm going to follow up those autoantibodies in a month because there are false positives. So we want to make sure that's true. So within a few weeks, I'm going to recheck their autoantibody levels. And if I haven't done so already, I'm going to do a more complete glucose screen as well, probably with a 2-hour oral glucose challenge. And all those patients I will refer. It's a little complicated, frankly, the algorithms with adults versus kids and one autoantibody positive versus multiple. Multiple is worse. Yeah, you're certain, you know, the certainty of progressing on when you have two or more autoantibodies and they are consistently tested positive over time. That's near 100% risk of lifetime development of stage 3 type 1 diabetes. But if you only have one, that risk drops substantially down to only 13%. So there's a lot of factors that go into how often you follow and what you should be doing in terms of monitoring for glucose. Patient education is universal. Everybody should be educated when they have a positive autoantibody test of the risks of overt diabetes and DKA in particular. But that said, It's a lot to keep up with. I'm still managing these patients for their hypertension and their headaches and depression and all the other things that patients come in for. So I really want an endocrinologist on board for those patients. For those who test negative, if they're at high risk, I still might get an endocrinologist on board just because we're going to be, especially in a pediatric patient, in a younger patient, you know, say under school age, a toddler, we're probably going to be following that patient for multiple tests. Them, I might want an endocrinologist to follow along with me. But for other folks, when there's a lower pre-test probability that they actually are going to have type 1 diabetes and they test negative, say an adult with that, with that type 2 diabetes, it wasn't behaving, then I would say, yeah, those patients, they test negative. I don't necessarily need a referral. I really try to be judicious in my use of specialists, but it's a pretty complicated issue in terms of testing and staging, but it's also really important because if you catch them at that right stage, you can initiate disease-modifying therapy. That's why it's important to know and act.
Thank you. And that kind of brings me to my next questions. And you talked about the benefits of early detection to intervene with disease-modifying therapies, teplizumab being available now and others being in investigation. Kind of like building off from the prior question, how do you see the role of primary care, like not only facilitating screening and diagnosis of pre-symptomatic T1D, but also identifying or referring the right patients to specialty care that might be eligible for treatment with these therapies?
Yeah, so absolutely. So we want to make it clear that that teplizumab is effective. It's a 14-day daily infusion. So they have to go to a center that does infusions. And there is a risk of infusion reactions, albeit rare for a serious risk. So they have to be able to, one, pre-medicate patients, two, be able to respond to an emergency, and they have to be in that specific stage 2 type 1 diabetes. So there is time to do it, but whenever I see a case like this, where maybe they're in stage 1, they haven't developed the dysglycemia that marks stage 2 yet, I'm really trying to make sure that we're all aware and we're on top of it, because I don't want them to do is go missing for 9 months and then show up in the emergency department with DKA, at which point it's too late. They're not going to get a drug like teplizumab. So it does take a lot of education for patients and their care partners, and then some communication, I think, between the specialist office with endocrinology and myself. And teplizumab may not be offered at every endocrinology practice, so therefore it's incumbent upon us to find someone somewhere where they can receive it if the patient decides to go that way. And then finally, of course, we have to get the patients to buy in. And, in the case of kids, we want their people caring for them to be bought into this as well with teplizumab, that they understand what its benefits are, what its risks are, and they're making an independent decision to pursue therapy.
Thank you. And then just going a little bit deeper on that, during when the patients are receiving the 14-day treatment course, and obviously this takes place in a setting that has specialized personnel that can identify, monitor, and address adverse events, but is there a role for primary care in working as part of a multidisciplinary team in helping monitor patients during this 14-day treatment course? And then also, after the treatment is done, helping to evaluate response to treatment in terms of not only safety, but also in efficacy, and whether that patients will develop stage 3 or what is the response to treatment after the course has been completed.
Right. So, So in the main clinical trial, the rate of overt type 1 diabetes, that stage 3 where there's hyperglycemia, was delayed by around two years, 5 years after treatment teplizumab. And there was a follow-up study at 6 years. There was even a greater delay versus those folks who received a placebo infusion. So during the infusion, yes, absolutely, it can be a tough time because there can be, particularly the first few days, there can be reactions such as fever, nausea, itching, rash. So pre-treatment is necessary. It seems to be that those things really do fade over time. So over the next 10 days of treatment. But I think you want to be there for patients. I think it's very important for PCPs to get because there is going to be a period that is transient, but it can last for several weeks where patients will have a lower immune response. So we want to be aware of that. So get all vaccines on board before initiation of treatment with teplizumab. I think that's one thing that's important. Teaching good hygiene for infection control practices, I think that's very important. But you're right. I think the challenging part is kind of long-term follow-up. That takes communication to me between the endocrinologist and the PCP. Like, I don't mind ordering a two-hour oral glucose tolerance test, but the timing of it and when that happens, it's nice to agree on a schedule, for routine, observation. Many times patients see me way more often than they see the specialist, and we know that everybody's really busy. So just to have that schedule in hand, so when I see the patient, I can say, "Hey, aren't you due in 2 weeks for another glucose test? And do you have that order? No, you don't. Okay, well, I'll write it right now. That way, we can cover each other's gaps because inevitably, in busy practices, those exist, and we want to be able to be there together to help preserve best care for the patient."
Thank you. And any final clinical pearls you wish to share for your primary care colleagues on the screening, early detection, and treatment of T1D?
Right. So look out for that family history and/or family history or personal history of autoimmune illnesses for folks who should be screened for type 1 diabetes. One thing I guess that a lot of clinicians are concerned about is insurance coverage. These tests are more expensive than our routine laboratory tests like a CBC or an A1C. That's true. But when I code it correctly, I see exclusively low-income patients, I've never had one turn back to me and not perform. So if you get the coding right about the family history and increased risk for type 1 diabetes, you shouldn't have a problem there. And then also on the other end, don't forget about the adults who maybe they were just diagnosed with type 2 diabetes a few months ago, but boy, that glucose is really skyrocketing despite treatment with, say, metformin and some other drug, say a GLP-1 agonist. Definitely think about in your head, like, hey, this is starting to look more severe, kind of like a case of autoimmune type 1 diabetes.
Those are some great pearls. Thank you so much, Dr. Vega, for taking the time to speak today about the evolving landscape of T1D and the important role that primary care plays in applying these advances to patient care. And I hope that all of you found this information beneficial for your practice. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you'll listen to another episode from this series. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group in support of improving patient care. MedLearning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, or ACCME, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, ACP, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center, ANCC, to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. I would like to also give a special thank you to our supporter, Sanofi US, who provided an educational grant for this activity. Thank you all again, and have a great day.